This is going to be a series of talks that is very, very fundamental astrology. Some of it will get a little bit deep, but basically it'll be all beginning things. I'm trying to do parallels. Like a couple years ago, we did a series of talks on the building of the soul body. And since then, I have converted other lectures so that there are five parallel talks on the astrology of the vital body. And then last year, we did working in desire, and then we did five talks on the astrology of the desire body. And this year, I'm trying to help everyone, myself included, to understand cycles. And so this series of astrology talks are going to be on the most basic cycle of all cycles. That is the most simple cycle between the sun and the moon, which is called the lunation cycle. Max Heindel spoke of it quite frequently. When he didn't speak about the words lunation cycle, he just used the word lunation. And a lunation is a period of time from one new moon until the next new moon, which is approximately 29 days. Now, some people, including Max Heindel, when they use the word lunation, use that to refer to the new moon and to the new moon only. We won't be using it that way. Now, all societies have looked at the lunation cycle. Some societies are primitive, some are sophisticated, and they all came to similar conclusions about the lunation cycle. In the primitive societies, new moons and full moons and sometimes quarter moons were seen as the time markers in nature. It was a kind of chronography. For example, the new moon, which is on Wednesday, in Native American astronomy or astronomical lore, in northern Wisconsin, this would be the new moon of the ripening of the blackberries. And they tied nature activities together with stellar activities. Now, in more sophisticated societies, there were names for every day of the lunation cycle. And the lunation cycle provided the background understanding for everything that was taking place in the heavens. It was followed so closely that they looked at the shape of the moon and the appearance of the moon when it first appeared after the new moon, and you could see it. So it's something that's been studied a lot. Like the Babylonians studied a 19-year cycle. In fact, the cycle is named to this day after a Babylonian astronomer called Saros. And every 19 years, there is a new moon in the same place of the zodiac on the same day of the years. And so that's called the cycle of Saros. And the Babylonian astrologers, or the Chaldean astrologers, which because Chaldea included more than Babylon, did a lot with that whole cycle. They probably knew every day and kept records of every day during that 19-year period. Now, there are a lot of other cycles between the sun and the moon. In fact, there are astronomy books that have a whole page of different kinds of sun-moon cycles. Very, very worthwhile studying. There are the tidal cycles of the various kinds of high and low tides. They're a good source for understanding the nature of the lunation cycle also. There are entire astrological systems that are based on the sun and the moon. Like, for example, in China, they practice three different types of astrology, and two of those types of astrology were solely lunar. The most ancient one, which was also like the most ancient Babylonian, is that the sun was considered the masculine principle, the yang, and the moon was considered the yin. And all of the other planets were associated with the other five elements, wood, water, and so on. And if a planet set closer when it was rising or setting, if it set closer to where the sun rose or set, it was called, like, for example, a yang Mercury or a yang Saturn. And if it set closer to the moon, it was called a yin moon. And for them, if the sun and moon were together in rising and setting in declination, that is, if it was an eclipse, that meant the start of a whole big cycle, and the yin and the yang forces were completely balanced and working together to one end. So this is pretty serious business. In fact, in China, there were two astronomers that got drunk, and they were out on a binge, and they did not report an eclipse of the sun, and they were beheaded because they were didn't keep their mind on the job. Now, in all astrology, there are all kinds of other cycles between other planets. And they are studied also, but they're all studied relative to the cycles of the sun and the moon. One of the cycles that's almost untouched by astrology is whether the moon is riding high or whether the moon is riding low. There are things in the system of parallels of astrology that can be found that way. There are, even in modern astrology, that is within the last century, there are astrologies that are based completely on the relative positions of the sun and the moon as the basic markers of character within a horoscope. I have some of those books either for sale or for loan that talk about those things. So everywhere in all times, the cycle of the sun and the moon has been fundamental. It has been the basis of everything. And it's probably the most observational of all of the different cycles, so that it's easy to draw intuitive concomitance between the events that are happening in the heavens and the events that are happening on Earth. I still hear a lot of reports when I listen to some of the alternative radio shows, people calling in saying it must be a full moon because we have many more crazy people doing crazy things and we have to take care of all of that. My own father, my natural father, was a small town plumber, which meant that he was also a small town bill collector because people didn't pay their bill. It was, you know, just, yes, please fix this, and then when you catch me, you can get your money. And I heard it many times in my youth. My father would say, well, the moon is filling up, so I can go out collecting now. He had found over the years that it was much more successful to collect money from people who owed him money during the waxing moon than it was during the waning moon. And I used to be very, very skeptical of all of that as a teenager, especially. I was very skeptical, and I've had to eat a lot of crow since then. Max Heindel recommends starting things under a waxing moon if you want to have success. And success is more likely in that. The great poet Dante, in the Divine Comedy, mentions outright that the waxing moon is the moon of the active life, whereas the waning moon is the moon of the contemplative life. And the great Irish poet, William Butler Yeats, has a whole system of character analysis based on the 28 stages of the moon, the 28 days of the moon. He saw the sun and the moon as antinomies, two opposing forces, and that when they combined in various ways, they produced varying shades of character. It's a book called A Vision, and even some of the poems in the poetry of William Butler Yeats are based on the sun and moon cycle, and he tries to indicate various types of characters and develop them in the course of a poem using the sun and moon cycle. Now, without getting into all kinds of fine point character distinctions, it's fairly easy to see that the things of the world are bound together with the cycle of the sun and the moon. Everyone, primitive, sophisticated, ancient, or modern, agrees that things get done according to the cycle of the sun and the moon. For that reason, all of the building and all of the unbuilding, sometimes the cycle is called the cycle of construction and destruction. I prefer to think of it as the cycle of accomplishment. And so all of this week, we're going to be talking about the cycle of accomplishment. Now, some of this requires clarification, because there are other cycles between other planets, and they certainly do things too. However, even if there is very strong activity coming from the other planets, the finalization of it and the bringing it down to Earth is all accomplished by the sun and the moon. You might say that the sun and the moon are the father and the mother of all things. Everything is accomplished according to the sun and the moon. If we understand the basic ideas of the lunation cycle, we can take those ideas, the ideas we're going to be talking about all of this week, we can abstract them and we can apply them to all of the other planetary cycles. And that's a very, very valuable thing to do. The important thing is to get a feel, because intellectually you can understand something, but you can't really put it into practice until you get a feel for how the psychic or the astrological atmosphere is at any given time. Now, we're going to look today observationally at the lunation cycle. We're going to look at the lunation cycle during the course of the week so many different ways that you're going to be sick of the lunation cycle by the end of the week. And we're going to look at the cycle the way you would see it with your eyes if you took the time to do it. And we're going to do two simplifications. One of the simplifications is something that I don't always feel comfortable with. I'm not going to speak in a very explanatory way. I'm going to be somewhat authoritative in order to just get the simple principles down and stated, and we can discuss later, like next year or something. At the end of the week, I'm leaving a little bit of extra time in the last talk so that there's room for questions. The second simplification is we're going to look at the lunation cycle as if the sun stood still. That is, as if the sun wasn't moving, because it's hard to have two moving bodies and to see the whole cycle, but it's much simpler if you have the sun standing still and the moon moving around it. It's true that they are both moving, but sometimes truth is a very difficult kind of thing. Boy, I'm still having a hard time reading here. Well, let's start. All cycles begin with the conjunction. And the conjunction of the sun and the moon is called a new moon. Something is born. The moon has everything from the past cycle is gone and it's invisible. And the intimacies between the Heavenly Father and the Heavenly Mother are invisible. And the first stages of all creation are invisible. They begin inwardly. And so that things done in the dark of the moon, as it is called, are things that are very often very inner things. After the dark of the moon, about usually a day and a half at a minimum, you can begin to see the sliver of the moon, the first visible evidence of the new moon. And it's usually seen in the evening right after the sun sets. And because it's so tiny, it's hard to see it before the sun sets. And so that is the new moon that is building up. And it's sometimes called a baby moon and has been referred to that by all societies because it is like an infant and you don't know what it's going to be like. That's one of the whole characteristics of the new moon. Things begun at the new moon, you don't know what they're going to be like because you can't tell right away. So it's like a baby that has just been born when you see the first sliver. Now when the moon, oh my goodness. When the moon is just a sliver, the points of the moon, since it's just a little arc, are often referred to as the horns. And it's said that the moon has horns. And if you watch each day after the new moon, the crescent will be a little bit thicker. It'll be a little bit more obvious. And it will be a little further away from the sun. But the points of the moon, whether the moon is waxing or waning, the horns of the moon always point away from the sun. So for the next few days, this pattern is continued. Crescent is a little bit thicker, and it's a little bit further away from the sun. 1 week after the new moon, the moon is at the midheaven when the sun sets. And half of the moon is lit and half of the moon is unlit. And because we can only see half of the moon, half of a half is a quarter. So this is called a first quarter moon. It's a first quarter moon because it's a quarter of the way through the cycle, and it's a quarter of a moon because one quarter of the moon is visible to the naked eye. Then evening by evening after that, the moon is further and further away from the sun, and it keeps getting larger. It waxes, is the term that is used. So this is called a waxing moon. It has been spoken of in various ways, cryptically, when it was, you know, in times of Catholicism were very hard on people who studied things like this. You were considered a witch or a child of the devil or something like that, you would see, and you find it in literature, they would say, Cynthia is pregnant. Cynthia was one of the names of the moon, and Cynthia being pregnant, meaning that she was filling up and up and up, and getting bigger. A moon that is between the first quarter and the full moon, that is filling up, but it is not yet full, is called a gibbous moon. It's a bulgy-shaped moon. About 2 weeks after the new moon, the moon is full, meaning to say that it has as much light, the entire circle of the moon is lit, with one exception, and that is if there is an eclipse, then the moon gets covered over. When it's exactly full, it gets covered over by the Earth, and it's you can see it as sort of a dark thing. It's still, you can see the whole circle, and it takes on various colors depending on the atmosphere of the Earth. Sometimes it can almost be a blood red moon, and there have been whole systems of omenology that have been based on looking at the moon when it's full and when it's eclipsed and what it looks like. Now, depending on the time of the year that it is and your geographical latitude, the moon will, when it is full, will rise fairly close to the exact time that the sun is setting. Sometimes of the year it rises before, and other times of the year it rises later. And then each day after the full moon, the moon continues to rise a little later after sunset. And it's a little bit smaller every day. After 1 week after the full moon, or 3 weeks and a little bit after the new moon, it is again a quarter moon, because half of the surface is lit or visible and half is not. And this is called a three-quarter moon, or the third quarter of the moon. After the three-quarter moon, the moon again takes on horns. And again, the horns are pointed away from the sun. Day by day it wanes and it gets slimmer and slimmer and thinner and thinner. And when the moon is extremely slim and close to the sun but not within orb, it is called a boon moon. At the new moon, when the moon gets back to the sun and moon rise together, and it is a time of conception in both heaven and earth. You might say that Cynthia then conceives. Now, all of these things are visible observations, but by having visible observations of things and relating them to life, you can get a sense of the invisible connectedness between everything that happens in the world. It also has a psychological effect on you. I have a friend who did a study of it over years, and I agree with it, that hyperactive people, it would be better for them to watch a lot of sunsets, whereas people who have difficulty getting things going and starting things, it would be better for them to watch sunrises. So it's one of those things that physical changes and psychological changes go side by side. And if you intentionally and consciously try to work with a process like this, you get the, it's much more effective. You know, you're building it right into yourself. It isn't just a matter of suggestion. Suggestion, you know, you can prove it to yourself without suggestion. You can just make the observations and then tell later on. Now, some people are so sensitive they can tell when a planetary hour changes from one ruler to another, and then they can check the book, and sure enough, it is just as they felt. So what I'm trying to say is that it is a very worthwhile thing to take the time, and summer is a good time to do it, and Wednesday starts a new moon, and just observe and take notes, especially of your own inner feelings, and do that every day for the next 28 days, and if you like, for the next 19 years. And it's really true. The ancient people knew about the precession of the equinox from observation, which means that the number of days from the equinox until the sun would conjoin a given star is pretty much constant. And in order for it to change one day, it takes 72 years. And they kept records of that several hundreds of years, in some places thousands and tens of thousands of years. They kept records, and that's how they knew about the precession of the equinox. They probably also knew from clairvoyance, but that's another matter. We don't have to even bring in clairvoyance when, somebody be begging too much to ask for clairvoyance when we're not even using the vision that we already have. I'm completely lost in the notes and I have a hard time. The whole cycle has a feel about it. And each stage and each day has a feel about it. There are some things that are better started right at the beginning of a waxing moon. And there are some things that are better started after the moon is quite mature. And if you know the kinds of things that you want to do, you can benefit quite a great deal by starting them at the right stages of the right moon. It all depends on what you want to do and how you can harmonize with the cosmos. As we said earlier, during the waxing half of the cycle, the sun gives to the moon, and the moon is the receiver. And as life goes on more and more, I become extremely paranoid about gifts, either giving them or receiving them, because gift giving is a kind of hegemony. And when somebody gives you a gift, to some extent, in your receiving that, to the degree that you do receive it, it has a power over you. I'm very cognizant of that when I give these talks, because what I have to offer has to be impersonal, and it has to be neutral, because I don't want to have power over you. It's a kind of giving that is meant to be a giving that is not hegemonious. But in any case, if you see, the giver has power over the taker, or over the receiver. This is especially so for people who depend on the largesse of other people. They are in the hands of those other people. So it is safe to say that the first half of the cycle is ruled by the sun. Now the sun, we know from both Rosicrucian philosophy and just simple observation, is a planet of energy and vitality. In our own inner constitution, our vital bodies were begun in the sun period. The moon, as seen in the Rosicrucian philosophy, is a planet of form. It consolidates things. It informs them. It crystallizes them. In some cases, if the crystallization is carried too far, it is death. So, during the first half of the cycle, the sun is giving its life and energy to the moon. And the moon is consolidating and it is building at it. There's another way we can look at this, and we can say that the moon is the divine feminine relative to the sun, and the divine feminine is imagination in the same way that the divine masculine is will. And you can look at the first half of the cycle as the imagination drawing out the power of the will of the divine masculine. And in the spiritual worlds, Trinitarian thinkers of all ages have concluded that the divine masculine and the divine feminine work so closely together. They have even special words that they use for it. They work so closely together that it's hard determining who is in control and who isn't. You know, if you're drawing somebody out, you have almost as much power as if somebody is informing you and pouring their energy into you. So it's possible to look at the whole cycle in that way. Now, in the second half of the cycle, the moon gives back the light to the sun. And the moon is then the giver. And this means that the moon is in charge of the second half of the cycle. It's in control because it is the one that is giving. Now, the time of the full moon, when there is a transition from the solar half of the cycle to the lunar half of the cycle, it's a time of indecision. You know, it's like passing something on to the next generation. It's in that time in between that it's difficult. There's people who are born under a full moon, as we'll see on Friday, are very often indecisive people. And at the time of the full moon, the moon is in its glory. It is as lunar as it is ever going to be. It is the lunar qualities and everything that we associate with the moon are more present at the full moon than at any other time. Because things are breaking down and they're being contemplated, and the same force that is involved with the giving back of the light to the sun is at its strongest right after the full moon. The moon is a drawing planet. And this is why in Rosicrucian philosophy, if we are to draw the essence out of our past memories and to analyze them and see what they mean in our character development, that is best done at the time of the full moon. So like there are special spiritual exercises and there are even special ceremonies that are for the new moon and the full moon, because those forces have their sway, and there are certain kinds of work that can be done at that time that are done best for the entire cycle. It's also very much a time to be aware of all the biological qualities of the moon. Biological forces are at their height at the full moon. But most of all, it is a time, since the sun represents self, to see what is being given back to you. To see the creation that you started at the new moon, when it comes back to you at the full moon, to see what it actually is like. What did you do? And it's exactly like the line of poetry from Blake, who said, he's talking about the tiger, that he who make the lamb make thee, meaning to say when you have to see, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Meaning to say that when God looked down on the creation of the tiger, was God able to say it is good, as it was in the this poetic statement of it, but the Bible is primarily poetic. So what we're talking about is that during the waning half of the cycle, we look back and see what we did to know whether we have succeeded in what we wanted to do. So it's a time of analysis and a time of contemplation. It's analogous to the life cycle, which we're going to be speaking of some tonight. And it's analogous also to the whole cycle of creation. In the second half of the evolutionary creation of which we are taking place, in which we are taking place, the physical worlds begin to dissolve and they go back into decadence. And we, at that time, absorb all of the soul from all of our different lives in different kinds of forms and the different experiences that we've had. And that is a time that is physical decadence, but at the same time, spiritual wisdom and the growing in soul. And that's what the second half of the moon is like. Things don't function well. It's like older age. Things don't function well, but what you get out of them is much better, because you have now the understanding that things can go into decadence and everything will be all right. So this is the cycle of light, the cycle of spiritual light becoming materialized and of material light being reflected and being spiritualized. The moon, toward the end of the cycle, gives up everything that it has. And it's empty, and it's in need. And so the quality at the end of the cycle is something like that. It's something desperate. It's almost something that is a matter of collapse. So we'll start getting to some of that now. So that's roughly a statement from all kinds of different sources, from all kinds of different people who have followed the moon throughout history. And now the rest of the week we're going to start getting into the details. Now, anybody who studied astrology knows that in applied astrology, the aspects are the most important parts of astrology. The aspects are the modes and means of accomplishing things. They are the tools. They are the doers. It is through them that things, divine things, are implemented in the physical cosmos. The aspects are the times when the energies are made concrete, they're put into use. And when you do that, things change. And what we're saying in this whole week that we're going to look at, we are going to look at the five most basic aspects and the places that they occur in the cycle. Those basic aspects are the conjunction, which is a new moon, sextile, the square, the trine, and the opposition. Those are the five tools, most basic tools, in the building and unbuilding work that is done in the cycle. This means two planets are 0 degrees apart, the conjunction. The sextile means that they're 60 degrees apart. Square means that they're 90 degrees apart, the trine that they are 120 degrees apart, and the opposition that is that when they are 180 degrees apart. This is more or less because there is the orb of influence. things don't happen only on the exact aspect, they happen within orb of that aspect. So we have to remember that in this process, this is a figure we're going to see a lot all week, at the conjunction, the sun and the moon are together. At the full moon, they are 180 degrees apart. But there are two places that they are 60 degrees apart. There are two places where they are 90 degrees apart. And there are two places where they are 120 degrees apart. Not very accurate. So what we're going to say, in doing what we're going to do, we're saying that the energy of the new moon, when the moon gets to the sextile position of the sun, something is accomplished. And that accomplishment has a tone. But when the moon is at the end of the cycle and coming back to the sun, that it has something, the undoing work is done. So we're saying then that there are two kinds of sextiles, two types of squares, two kinds of trines. And we're also saying that if this is the exact sun, that when the moon is within orb, but right up until right until the end of the moon, that is a second conjunction. But when the moon is just leaving the sun until it leaves orb, that is a first conjunction. And similarly with the opposition, the first is everything. The first is everything up to the exact, and the second is everything after the exact until it's out of orb. So we're saying that there are two sextiles, two trines, two conjunctions, that there are two of each of them. And each of them has a very different kind of quality. The first conjunction, all cycles begin with the conjunction. And so there's this one side, there's this one conjunction, the before and after kind of picture, you might say, and they each have a different thing for them. And this is much more than a distinction of words. Because if you look at the time right before the new moon or right after the new moon, they have a very different quality. And it's like that with anything. If you're starting something and building up to the start, there's all kinds of anxiety and things like that. But once you start something, it's a totally different flavor. So each of these, each of the conjunctions, which we're talking about today, each of the conjunctions is very different from every other one. Now, when you start things, the attitude of the first conjunction, which we're going to talk about right now, is like a burst of energy. Nothing can get in the way. Nothing can stand between myself and what I want to do. And that energy is indeterminate. Because if you look in the garden, you have to have some experience and you have to discriminate. Because when the sprouts come out of the ground, they come out and a lot of them look like each other. And it's hard to tell what's a weed and what is a plant. And that's the way things are when they're indeterminate. They're strong, though. When a new sprout is forming, some people think this statement is absurd, but Max Heindel said that they used to launch craft to get them off of the ground using the etheric energy from the sprouting of seeds. The sprouting of a mushroom can push through 6 inches of asphalt. It can just push itself right up. A sprout that God is my nemesis. Don't look at the garden, it's a weed patch. But my nemesis, the quack. The quack sprouts, which are called rhizomes, they go underground. And the new energy, when it's sending out a new rhizome, you can take the rhizome in your finger and you can take it, you can break it. But the energy is so intense that it will pierce right through quarter-inch plywood. So if you want to keep your quack from spreading, you have to have something that's quite hard and quite substantial. We find it in babies. If you look at the face of a baby, they all have those round, bougie cheeks, and they look quite similar to each other. But if you take old people, even twins, when they have developed character in their face, they stand out distinctly different from each other. So the quality of the first conjunction is indifferentiability. It is, everything seems alike, and it has to be that way. If you're going to make a breakthrough and you're going to start something that has never been started before, you need a certain kind of personality to break through and to get into that. Therefore, all simple beginnings, and the whole tone of simple beginning is what the first conjunction between the sun and the moon is like. Now let's look. I did only a dozen, so that some of you may have to share with each other. These are the horoscopes we're going to be looking at today. By the end of the series, you're going to have a big pile of horoscopes. Since this is a summer school of the philosophy of the Rosicrucian Fellowship, I thought we would begin by looking at the horoscope. I don't have a computer yet. I could save all this paper, and eventually I'll have a computer and of the kind that I can project. What? No. Applying and separating is something different. This is applying when it's moving into the aspect and it's separate. But there is an applying here and a separating here also, and applying here and a separating. Yeah. All right. Good outlook. All right. The first horoscope is the horoscope of Max Heindel, who is the founder of the Rosicrucian Fellowship. Now, if you were to select somebody to start a whole movement, you couldn't choose a better horoscope than this. It is the starting of a movement, and it is a renewal from the past. Over the years since I first read The Cosmoconception by Max Heindel, I have found most of the contents, even the Christ mystery, from sources as early as 1,400 years before The Cosmoconception was written. But in the Rosicrucian philosophy, which began in the early part of the 20th century, everything is renewed, and everything is said in a different way. It's a very practical, useful kind of philosophy, and this is what the new moon does. It is a renewal. He respected all of the past, as did the elder brothers of the Rosicrucian order, who were beings from the past, but everything from the past was stated in new ways. And new things were added as a result of research from people. The position of this new moon in this horoscope is very interesting in that it is in the 12th house. And the moon conjoins the ascendant. This no doubt means that Max Heindel, since the 12th house represents the immediate past, and destiny usually hung over from an immediately preceding rebirth, it indicates that he had earned the right in order to be a founder or in order to be a starter of a society like this. And it shows that he preferred to be a behind-the-scenes person and let all of the energy go forward into the world. Now, what's really interesting about this horoscope is that the sun and the moon do not form any really significant aspects with anything else in the horoscope. And that is exactly what the Elder Brothers of the Rosicrucian Order were looking for. They were looking for somebody who would do this and this only, not mix it together with this and this and this and talk of, you know, there are people who do that, and they're important people, but for a simple statement like, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all this will be added unto you, that's what this horoscope is like, and that's exactly what the Elder Brothers were wanting. That was the requirement. Things were undifferentiated. The differentiation can come later. That's what our work is. That's up to us. All right, let's move along really quickly. I'm trying to keep this within an hour, but I might not make it today. The second horoscope. This is a founder, but not an official founder or something like that. It is the horoscope of Paul Hindemith. He was a famous composer, conductor, performer, and promoter of modern classical music. This is, again, somebody that is born in the first conjunction. The sun is separating from the moon. And in this case, it's in Scorpio and in the fifth house. The fact that he was a performer, if this had been a 12th house chart, this would be somebody that would like to be a composer behind the scenes. But this is somebody, because everything was in the fifth house, he was a performer. And not only that, he promoted. He promoted Schoenberg and other modern composers of his time. He had admiration for them, which is kind of unusual for a Scorpio, I guess. Again, this is a sun and moon which are pretty much isolated from the rest of the chart. There is a fairly round conjunction with Uranus, but that's all isolated from everything else. And this is, again, a single-minded kind of individual who has one thing that he wants to do and one thing only. He's very, very concentrated. He was so concentrated that when he told his parents that he wanted to be a musician when he grew up, and he said, well, you have nice talent, but you don't want to do that. So he ran away from home when he was 11 years old so that he could become a musician. He wanted that, and nothing else was going to get in the way of that. He had that kind of consciousness. Now, Scorpio is not known for being a temperate sign. If you ever listen to any of his music, at first he started with romanticism, and then he went into modern music, which is really tough to deal with sometimes. And then at the end, he experimented with some neoclassicism. But if you ever hear any music by Hindemith, what you hear is something that, where the feelings are really intense. And so this is somebody who had concentrated intensity. The intensity is the scorpion kind of quality. And the thing that he's most famous for is that he wrote a book about harmonies, in which he took the most simple harmonies and carried them to the most dissonant harmonies. And in his music, he worked with dissonance a lot. And if you look at the keywords for Scorpio that Max Heindel gave in the most elementary astrology, one of the key words for Scorpio is dissonance. this was single-minded dissonance. All right, let's quickly move on to the next horoscope. What we're doing here is we're not talking about everything in the horoscope. We don't want to do that. And we're sometimes not even talking about the strongest things in the horoscope. We're talking about things that illustrate in the lives of the people, in the character of the people, the point that we're trying to make about each of the aspects. The next chart is a chart of another person who is a famous musician. This is Annie Lennox. And she's a... What? Yes. She's, well, the Eurythmics. She was in several major groups, but the Eurythmics, I think, was the most famous one. She's an extremely talented person, born in Scotland, and she went to a conservatory of music and went to almost the last day for being pedigreed as a musician, and she quit. And so she went into the rock and pop scene, and she made it there very, very well. She was an avant-garde popular musician, and she's most noted for songwriting in very simple, sparse lyrics. And Capricorn is the sign of keeping it simple, keeping it very condensed. She's also new moon-like in that she was one of the movers in the unisex notion, that men and women are all one particular sex. And she was also noted again for simplicity. Let's quickly move on to the next horoscope. Yes, I don't think that Mercury combust the sun necessarily means someone who is made stupid by that aspect, by having that aspect. What I find is it is more likely to be something that takes away from the intelligence of the person if it occurs in a fixed sign. And if that fixed sign happens to be Taurus or Scorpio, it's even more likely. And I find that what it has to do with is abuse by excessive expression of the sexual energy, so that the sexual energy, when it comes up the spine, has a more difficult time getting past the mercurial segment of the spine and into the higher consciousness. There are some people that are so sexually extreme in one life, they can't even bring anything in the cranium in the next life, and they can't build. But combust Mercury doesn't necessarily mean that a person is stupid. In some cases, it can be very sharp. This is a very good example. Sometimes statements like that are taken to extreme, and that's why you have to approach astrology completely with intuition, because combust Mercury in one sign may be very astute, and in the next horoscope, it is a dum-dum. All right. Sophisticated vocabulary there. All right. The next horoscope is the horoscope of John Maynard Keynes. This is probably one of the most brilliant and one of the most influential men of the 20th century. His name is John Maynard Keynes, and he was the father of what is called macroeconomics. And sometimes it's even called Keynesian economics. And like many Geminis, you see that there's quite a bit focused in Gemini in this horoscope. He was a master debater. And like Geminis, he could take either side of the issue. And he was excellent in that way. He was a founder of a different kind of thinking. A different kind of thinking, a new way of thinking that is based on Gemini. Now, the two-sidedness or the bilateral thinking of him caused him to be hated in all quarters. In macroeconomics, there is the belief that the government should take an active role in the economy, which is what some of his followers did, most notably Franklin Roosevelt and the people that surrounded Roosevelt. They said that in order to come out of this depression, the government is going to have to spend money. And that will break the hold of all of the people who are, how would you say it, constipated in their psychology, and they want to hold on to money and they don't let it flow. Keynesian economics believes like you have to be breathing, that the economy has to breathe and it has to go in and out and it has to have both cycles of consciousness. As a result of all of this, the right-wingers hated Keynesian because they said the government should have no part in economics and we should have what is called a free market, which means a free market for all the rich people who can monopolize and control it. And when the government gets in there and it has a bigger economy than their individual private wealth, that's no fair. Of course, monopoly isn't very fair either. So you can see that why he was hated. On the other hand, he was a capitalist. He was an astounding investor without inside knowledge. During one period after the Depression, he lost, like everybody else, he lost a lot of money in the Depression. But after the Depression, when the economy had increased by 2%, his portfolio had increased by 35%, which is an astounding amount for investment. And of course, this made all of the left wing hate him because he believed really in capitalism, not just financial capitalism, that you make money by putting money in and taking it out. You don't give anything to society when you just put money in and take it out. He believed that you put money into something that had promised and you help that company grow and you provided jobs that way. And so he was not an investment capitalist. It was more an investment capitalist and not a speculation capitalist. So he believed in fluency. And the Uranus part came in that he believed in stimulating incentive. And that stimulating incentive is what he used to get the world back going again when it was almost moribund during the global depression. Now, it's really interesting in this, and it's going to be interesting in relation to another horoscope that we're going to look at, is that he believed in administrative governmental intervention. And the 10th house is the house of administration and of governmental activities. And you can see that that was really a big thing for him, and he felt that there was a duty in doing things in that way. All right, we have one more to look at of the founders born under the first conjunction. This is the horoscope of a French pastry maker. A very famous French pastry maker who also happened to be the founder of modern Vietnam. the person who whooped the United States. Now, this horoscope is interesting in that the moon in this horoscope, which is that first conjunction waxing new moon, is in the Pleiades, which is a sign of genius. His particular genius was 12th house-like. It was behind the scenes. You might say that more than anyone else who brought it into the modern world and showed that it was effective against very large governmental armies and such like that was guerrilla warfare. He used guerrilla warfare to first defeat the French, then the United States, and the Russians, and China and Japan. They all had to let go of any kind of hold that they ever had. In the Second World War, he was helpful for the removal of Japan out of Indochina, as we call it. He was also very astute and pragmatic, which is the earthy part. Like these planets do conjoin Neptune, which shows that he has the feel of what is among the people, But the earthy sign part of the Taurus shows that it is pragmatic, that it has to be very useful. So that was what he was excellent in. And he's the kind of person, there's a square between that new moon and Saturn, which shows a building through resistance. And this is somebody, this is not the horoscope, even though it's a first conjunction, this is not the horoscope of a founder that founds by invading. This is the founder, one that founds by putting up a resistance. This is a resistance movement. All right. Now let's look at the second conjunction, which is an extremely different kind of conjunction. It isn't necessarily fatalistic or defeatist, but there's so much anticipation and there's so much giving up that it just, you know, it seems as if the moon falls into the arms of the sun. And if there is an attitude of inevitability. You even become so anxious, and you're not certain how things are going to be, but after a certain point, you seem it's inevitable that what is going to happen is going to happen. And that's what that second conjunction is like. The second half of the lunation cycle is a time of things are disassembled. And by this late in that second half, things have been taken apart and analyzed and absorbed. And there isn't much left to do. So this is the final disintegration. And the final disintegration that allows the moon to fall back into the sun so that things can start all over is a complete abandonment of control. You have to give it all up in order to be something new. And that's what this second horoscope, conjunction is like. Now, the horoscope that we're going to look at is, I just put it in because it's a trivial example. The birth time may not even be exactly right. It is listed in the data section where they rate the data. It's put in the X file because you don't know for certain about it. This is the horoscope of Payne Stewart, who was a famous professional golfer. And everybody loved him. But he died in a most unusual way. Maybe the first to die this way. He was at a golf tournament in Florida, and he had his own private jet. He was that successful. And they were flying home from a golf tournament in Georgia. Technophiles like to have their own private planes. We have Dr. Aquarius over there on the controls, one of those high-end technophile kinds of people. But a small leak developed in his plane. And very slowly, all of the oxygen was left out of the cabin. And everybody died, including the pilot. They lost control. They had no control over the plane. And the plane just kept flying on. It was under autopilot. And The Air Force was following the plane so that if it looked like it was going to come down near a city, they had orders to shoot it down. But what it did, it flew all the way from Florida north to North Dakota or South Dakota, one of the two, and then it ran out of gas and it just went into some farmer's field and that was the end of it. And when they did the postmortem, sure enough, they had all died of asphyxiation, but from lack of oxygen. All right, it's a good point just to make of lack of control. The next horoscope is the horoscope of Pierre Proudhon. Does everybody know who this is? This is the father of the philosophy of anarchism. He was a contemporary of Karl Marx. And he believed, the right wingers really loved him. See, what happens in a cycle like this, at the extremes, the extreme right and the extreme left are very much alike. The extreme left believes in perpetual revolution. The extreme right believes that the government should do nothing, which amounts to an anarchic thing. And this happens right here in Wisconsin. I have a friend that belongs to an organization that is called the Natural Foods Associates. And the Natural Foods Associates are big believers in everything being organic and such like that. And they have these annual conventions, usually up in the northern part of the state. And here you find the survivalists, but you'll find right-wing, like Posse Comitatus, and left-wing revolutionaries left over from the 60s. And they say, hey, man, we got to stop them from putting this poison in the soil. And they both agree with each other. They both have, let's have the government have hands off with everything that we do. But this is somebody that believed that there should be no organization to society at all. And the belief was that if everything is in the hands of the people, that the pragmatic functioning of the people would, everything would be taken care of. And you can see this, the sixth house, he believed in functioning. And this is another minimalist chart. It's a minimalist chart in that it's again Capricornian, and it wants to do as little as possible. And this is the opposed to the King's chart, because the King's chart, everything was in the 10th house, which was administration, and this is in the 6th house, where function dominates everything, and the function of everybody having to live and get on with things. He didn't advocate rebellion and, you know, like mass chaos in society or things like that. What he believed in was, just let them go, and things will correct themselves. I don't have much more to say about that, but it's a perfect chart of an anarchist kind of person. Now we have two charts. Oh, I don't have them here. Where are they? Okay. We have two charts that we want to look at together. We want to look at the horoscopes of Salvador Gallo Dali and Salvador Dali. I just included this in here for you to think on. I've been thinking on it, and I figure the more people that think on a problem, the better it is. And somebody's going to come up with a creative idea. Salvador Gallo Dali is the older brother of Salvador Dali, the famous but quite eccentric surrealist painter. Salvador Dali was really wigged out there. He was a strange man. I once saw an interview with him on early television, and in that interview, during the entire time that the interviewer was trying to interview him and hold a reasonable conversation, he had a raw beefsteak on his forehead. He's getting the whole interview that way. He was really wigged out there. Something like you don't run into often. But Salvador Gallo Dali died in his first year of life. And several years later, Salvador Dali was born. Now, I am wondering whether Salvador Dali is the rebirth of Salvador Gallo Dali. If you look at this, it's a collapse. Remember we said that it isn't necessarily fatalistic, but this is in the Salvador Gallo Dali. It is a collapse new moon. And at the same time, Mars and Venus are together in Scorpio, which indicates some extreme kind of decadence in a previous life, the kind of thing that would require extra moral training. And when a person dies in the first 14 years of life, but usually when they die very early, they are given special treatment in first heaven. And that special treatment gives them moral lessons that they might be missing otherwise. Very often people who die in a warfare in one life and their body is burned up by fire, when they're reborn, they die in childhood so that they can be given this extra training. People who are invisible helpers say that the young person's body is taken, and like, for example, if there's a barroom brawl going on, they put them right in that, and the child feels all the nasty vibrations, and then they take them to some place like where there's a symphony orchestra practicing or playing, and then they feel all of the harmony of that. And the juxtaposition of those things done over a number of years or a number of months, they get a moral training built into their desire body, because when the desire body is reborn, you know, when they're brought right back to birth within a few years, they have that extra training that they would otherwise not have had. Now, if we look at the next chart, the Salvador Dali chart, the sun is not in Libra like it was in the first chart. It's in Gemini, so it's a free-breathing chart. But the moon is in Taurus, which is Venusian. So the flavor of the moon sextile sun from between semi-sextile sun, I'm sorry, the flavor of that is not unlike the flavor of sun and moon together in Libra. They both have a Venusian quality, and they both have an airy quality. Mars and Venus are still in conjunction, but they are trine, Mars especially. Mars, Venus, Mars, Sun, and Pluto are all trine to Saturn, which indicates something like there is this kind of control. And Saturn is retrograde, and maybe that kind of control is looking back to a past life. Ooh, we're going too long. All right, let's look at the next chart. The next chart is the chart of Karl Marx. Looked at this a couple years ago. I don't think any of you have heard these talks, but relating to the chemical ether. And when there is too much focus in the chemical ether, one of the qualities of that is that a person gets tuberculosis or consumption. And Karl Marx's horoscope is a perfect example of materialism resulting in consumption. I like looking at charts again and again, but from different points of view. This time we're looking at the second conjunction in the lunation cycle. This is the moon conjoined sun in Taurus in the second house. Now, Saturn is rising and Pluto is rising. So this is a chart that looks a lot at history, and it looks at the heavy influences of things. And this Marx was a student of Hegel. And so he spent a lot of time looking at history. And he looked at history in great detail. And his, you know, in his writings, which were the foundation of communism, he had made predictions about communism being the next stage of evolution. And this shows the negative side of the end of the cycle. You're blinded. And he's blinded by coming to all of these conclusions about matter, materialism, finances, and things like that. And he has looked back so much at history that he doesn't look at other factors. And most of the predictions that he made in his writings on communism did not come true. And the reason they did not come true is because he was looking at the past and not at the present. If he had looked at Saturn as meaning individual selfish incentive, he would have realized that all of the experiments with communism would fail because they didn't allow enough for individual incentive for people to grow. And so that's about all I wanted to say, is, you know, that is the fact that the field that something is inevitable doesn't necessarily mean that what you think is inevitable is what is going to be inevitable. Like when you say, well, inevitably I'm going to die, that's probably a good statement. But if you say, inevitably some rich woman is going to come along and want to marry me, I don't think that that's an inevitability. So, all right. That would qualify not only as an inevitability, it would qualify as a miracle. Let's look at one last horoscope, because I didn't want to end on that much of a fatalistic outlook, because sometimes it happens that way. This is a fated person born very close to the end of the lunation cycle and in the 12th house at that. This is Giorgio Armani. And it is to say that life is not in your control, and often it is a fated, inevitable thing. Now, Giorgio Armani, basically, by the time he was done, he had earned $1.7 billion. And he basically fell into it. He started out to be a doctor. And then the war came along, and he couldn't do that. And he just took up any kind of job he could get. And he eventually became a window dresser. And as a window dresser, they saw he had a flair and he had a taste, and pretty soon he was designing clothes. And the next thing you know, he had his own company, and he just expanded rapidly after that. So it's the sort of thing, like some people, like the first conjunction, some people know what they want to do and they won't give up until they have done it. And that is a very, very important first conjunction attitude. The second conjunction attitude is like, if you've got it, you know, if you're ready for it, it's going to come, and whether you like it or not. And sometimes it may be very good. In some cases, it may be a lot of wealth and a lot of other things like that. And that's all we have to do this morning. We have a tradition. That in these things, when it is a function of the Rosicrucian Fellowship, we always close with the Rosicrucian prayer. I'll start it out, and we can all do it together for those of you who remember, and for those of you who don't, I'll print some things out tomorrow. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. I made a grammatical error. It was supposed to say the meditation of our hearts, because we're all supposed to have one meditation.